The point about climate change is that the evidence mounts from any number of sources, such as the population of birds in Australian forests. Alexandra de Blas reports.
South Australia's record November heatwave felt uneasily like the scientists' warnings that climate change is now tracking against their worst-case scenarios. The extended drought in southeastern Australia is taking its toll on both people and wildlife. As the climate warms and dries, a series of studies in northern Victoria's box ironbark woodlands has found that birds are disappearing at alarming rates. And it's not just in the bush remnants. The birds in the national parks are declining too. Monash and Deakin Universities ran three major studies over 13 years. As Professor Andrew Bennett, head of the School of Life and Environmental Sciences at Deakin, explains.
We're astonished when we put the results of these studies together. We found that they were all showing major decline in a whole range of woodland birds across the last 10 years. About 108 species we were dealing with, but two-thirds of species of all kinds had declined significantly.
And how much did they decline?
It varied. It was both some of the common species and the uncommon ones. So examples like the grey shrike thrush, a 20% decline. Even the laughing kookaburra that everybody knows, 30% decline. And then some of the other less common ones that people mightn't know, but black-chinned honeyeater, which is typical of feed woodlands, 66% decline. Crested bellbird, 65% decline. So quite large declines of these bird species.
Do you know how many birds overall have disappeared?
When I compare the first 2 years of surveys to the last 2 years, there was over 40% decline in the numbers of individual birds that are recorded there. And when you multiply that out to a forest of 40,000 hectares, that means more than 150,000 fewer birds in the forest now than there was when I started these surveys. And that's huge.
So what was causing it?
Well, we interpret it as complex changes resulting from long-term decline in rainfall. So there's been over 10 years of below-average rainfall, and that has a range of effects. So the first is there's less food. So there's less productivity, less insects, less flowering of eucalypts, and that then flows through to reduced reproduction. So their nesting is not as successful. And then there's other more complex effects because the forest dries out and the shrub layer becomes more sparse, and so there's less cover and less suitable areas for nest sites and for refuge. So it's a whole complex array of factors are acting to reduce the populations.
And what was going on with the flowering?
Well, the species of particular interest is the ironbarks. Red ironbark is the one that is a winter flowering species. They have large flowers, lots of nectar, and this is what the honeyeaters and the lorikeets and the wattlebirds come to. And when you have a heavy flowering event in winter, you can sort of hear where the flowering's occurring. There's just so many bird species and it's a cacophony of sound. And that's changed. Normally they're reasonably reliable flowers, but in the last 8 years, since 2002, in 4 out of 8 years, there's been essentially no flowering of red ironbarks. And so that means the nectar feeders aren't there. The nectar feeders that come from southern Victoria each winter don't come. So there's these wider ecosystem effects off the change in that resource.
Do you think those bird numbers would just bounce back if the rainfall increased?
Some species probably would if the rain increased, but the issue here is that these changes are occurring on top of 150 years of land use change. And we're talking about the sheep wheat belt of southeastern Australia, where in many districts we've lost 70, 80, 90% of the native vegetation. So it's this compounding of the effects of habitat loss and fragmentation and isolation with the climate change. And our concern is that we might be having a whole series of local populations disappearing one by one from these districts.
What needs to happen to help remedy the situation?
The first one is simply recognising we have a problem and recognising the scale at which we're taking action now does not match the scale of the problem, particularly loss of native vegetation. That's been the huge driver of these concerns. So the challenge now is, how can we put it back? How can we restore some of these areas to large-scale restoration? So we have landscapes that have 20% and 30% native vegetation present within them. And that's a huge challenge.
Is there sufficient policy focus and funding to make this happen?
Nowhere near enough. It just doesn't match the scale of the problem. We look at the Caring for Country initiative, and I think the figures are something like $2.4 billion over 5 years, and yet we have an economic stimulus package of $10 billion just before Christmas last year. We really need to rethink the priorities for how we spend money and where we spend money, and recognise that biodiversity conservation is something that affects us all and affects the future of Australia and affects the quality of life and our national heritage and who and what we are as Australians.
Professor Andrew Bennett from Deakin University. And now to the world stage, where about 20% of global carbon emissions are released when forests are either cut down or degraded. Addressing this problem is seen as one of the more effective ways to reduce emissions in the short term. A key policy to promote this will be negotiated at the climate talks in Copenhagen. It's known as RED, R-E-D-D, Reduced Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation in Developing Countries. Dr. Rachel Warren is a research fellow and computer modeller at the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research in the UK. She ran the numbers on several RED scenarios to see whether a political agreement on reducing deforestation could make a big difference.
For the fossil fuel emissions, we assumed that there was a very good agreement in which emissions were reduced by 80% relative to 2000 in 2050, which is a very, very large amount. So some countries at the moment are talking about making 80% emission reductions. So we assumed that all countries would do that. So we made the most optimistic assumption possible about the output of Copenhagen and then looked at what would happen if there was no agreement on reducing tropical deforestation and if all of the tropical forest was lost during the 21st century. Then we also looked at a scenario where there was, in addition to that very stringent agreement on fossil fuel emissions, a completely successful agreement to cease tropical deforestation immediately. And we compared those two scenarios. And we also looked at a third intermediate scenario in which tropical deforestation continued at current rates but didn't increase. And in that scenario, there is still some of the forest left at the end of the century.
So what did you find under the three scenarios?
So we found that in the case where tropical deforestation ceases immediately, that we had a chance of 2 in 3 that the 2-degree target would be met. So in other words, it was more likely than not that the world would not experience temperatures above 2 degrees ever, in fact. So right out to 2100 and beyond. We then found that if tropical deforestation continued at current rates, that chance would fall to 1 in 3. So in fact, that it would be more likely that we wouldn't reach the 2-degree target.
And that we'd overrun it.
Yes, and then we found that if deforestation increased so that all the forest was gone by 2100, that the probability of achieving a 2-degree target would fall to about 10 or 15%. So it would become very unlikely that we could meet the 2-degree target.
What's the power of this finding then? How significant is this research?
Well, I think it's a very significant advance on previous research because previous research didn't look at deforestation in the context of stringent action on fossil fuels. So no one until now has looked at the balance between potential action on fossil fuels and potential action on forests. Meanwhile, everybody's talking about offsetting one against the other. And so I think this is a very important study because it actually shows that, you know, whilst offsetting may be a useful political mechanism, we actually need a huge amount of action, both on fossil fuels and on reducing deforestation, if we're to achieve the 2-degree target.
Rachel Warren from the Tyndall Centre at the University of East Anglia. The two major sources of carbon emissions can be thought of as black and green. Black carbon emissions come from burning fossil fuels like coal, oil and gas, while green emissions come from terrestrial sources like deforestation and land degradation. Brendan Mackey, Professor of Environmental Science at the Australian National University, says it's important not to confuse these two carbon reservoirs.
Currently, the main approach governments are considering is to view these two sources of emissions as comparable in that you can offset fossil fuel emissions by planting some more trees. And in reality, protecting the carbon stocks that are in natural ecosystems and restoring degraded carbon stock does not actually offset fossil fuel emissions. It's an additional measure to reducing emissions from fossil fuel.
If we're emitting fossil fuels and then we plant trees, which helps offset some carbon, why does it matter if the original cause was fossil fuel or it was clearing land initially? If you're improving the situation, isn't that worth recognition?
Well, where do you plant trees? Well, you plant trees where they naturally would grow. If there are no trees there now, that means the land's been cleared, in which case there's a carbon debt, if you like, that has to be repaid. So when the land was cleared, the carbon that was in those ecosystems was emitted into the atmosphere, and from a strict scientific point of view, if you're going to then plant new trees on previously cleared land, that's a good thing to do because you're repaying the carbon debt from when the land was cleared, not because you're offsetting fossil fuel emission.
But isn't this just being pedantic?
It's not being pedantic, and that's because once a pulse of CO2 gets into the atmosphere, it continues to interact with the climate system for a very long period of time. The challenge is to keep carbon out of the atmosphere for as long as possible. So it takes thousands of years for carbon, once it's been released into the atmosphere, to no longer be interacting with the climate system. So when you clear land, there's a carbon debt that takes many, many hundreds of years to repay.
If we want to acknowledge the significance of this green source of carbon and we want to stop emitting more from natural landscapes, how do we have to look at things differently? What do we need to do now to start actually acting on that?
So I would argue we need two different sets of policies and measures. A cap and trade scheme, such as a carbon pollution reduction scheme the government's proposing, I would argue may well prove to be very successful, but I would limit it to cap and trade of fossil fuel. I would put a barrier and not allow any offsetting into the terrestrial carbon sector. We need complementary measures for land carbon, the green carbon in terrestrial ecosystems on land, which is more along the line of payments for ecosystem services or land stewardship payments.
Professor Brendan Mackey from ANU. Fiona McKenzie is a policy advisor with the Terrestrial Carbon Group, a think tank with 18 members across the globe. She's cautious about drawing distinctions between different types of carbon in the marketplace.
I think what's important is not so much the distinction between different sources of carbon, but in making sure that greenhouse gas reduction targets that countries set and that the international community sets are ambitious enough to reflect any abatement potential that's available from all those sources. So as long as the numbers add up at the end of the day, there are mechanisms and ways of accounting for the different sources. It's not so important to split hairs over the definitions.
Is it honest to account for tree planting as offsets for fossil fuel emissions when in fact tree planting is repaying a carbon debt created when the original trees were cleared in the first place?
Well, in this case, it's actually not necessarily just repaying a debt. It's actually providing an incentive to change future land use. So what a lot of people are arguing for and looking for is some sort of incentive system that creates a new economic development option for people in developing countries other than having to chop down trees, for example. The opportunity of linking terrestrial carbon to other carbon markets means that there's a chance to generate in the long term a sustainable source of funding to keep that incentive system going. So I think it should be viewed in the context which is being realistic about the pressures that are going to be on forests in the future and other sources of terrestrial carbon, and actually creating the value, the economic value necessary to protect the carbon that's in the land.
Your terrestrial carbon group is looking at a wide range of sources of terrestrial carbon that you'd like to see incorporated into the carbon market in the future. Give me some examples of the sort of sources you're looking at.
So we're looking at sources not just from forestry, but also from agriculture. We're also looking at the options of both above ground, so that's things like wood, trees, grasslands, and below ground, so that's organic carbon in the soil. Also looking at things like peatlands, for example, which are a really crucial sink or source as well of terrestrial carbon. So it's important that the system that's in place actually has some sort of commitment to eventually including all these other pools that are interacting with the atmosphere to get to the scale that we need to get the results that we need.
Australia's systems for measuring and monitoring carbon in the field are world-leading. But Margaret Blakers, director of the Canberra-based Green Institute, believes there's a lot of room for improvement in the way we structure and present our carbon accounts.
If you go to look at the figures for what's called land use change and forestry, so that's all the things that happen on the land, you'll get a single number. In the 2006, it was 14 million tonnes. If you open that up, pull it apart, then you can see that there are actually huge changes taking place within that single number, some of which is forests taking carbon out of the atmosphere, some of it's logging, some of it's clearing, some of it's plantations, some of it's grasslands. And until you can pick all that apart and get some idea of what's happening in each of those individual ecosystems, there's nothing you can do in terms of deciding what sort of policies to implement.
But don't we follow the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change system?
Yes, we do, and that's a good thing, but there's nothing to stop Australia getting into far more detail and developing its own more useful accounts. As long as they remain consistent with the international methodology, it doesn't have to stop there. Australia can go beyond that. I mean, we have many types of financial accounts. What an enterprise does for its activities is different from what a federal or a central government collects by way of financial accounts. Carbon is the same. We need to get accounting structures and presentations that are suited to the use that they're going to be put.
A much more sophisticated approach.
Much more sophisticated, but much more open. That's really the bottom line here, that at the moment we don't have any real openness about the accounts and how they're put together. And I'd really like to see that whole accounting framework opened up to a much wider public discussion.
Margaret Blakers at the Green Institute in Canberra, and that report by Alexandra de Blas. A question of openness once more.